Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Tuesday, May the 30th, 2023. A couple of what we might think of as ex-entrepreneurs are in the news today. Elizabeth Holmes, according to the New York Times, has reported to a relatively low security prison to begin her 11-year sentence for one kind of robbery or another. The Wall Street talks about her as the Theranos founder, reporting to a Texan prison. Meanwhile, her brother in crime, if that's the right way to describe it, Sam Bankman-Fried, is back in the news. Prosecutors say that his bid to dismiss the charges is meritless. I think he may be meritless. And the Journal is reporting that he might have some charges drops if the Bahamas objects. What this speaks about, though, is the dark end of the entrepreneurial spectrum, when things get completely out of control with both Bankman-Fried and Holmes. One man who has done a lot of thinking about the darker end of entrepreneurship is my guest today. Neil Seaman is a successful entrepreneur himself from Canada, founder of a successful data company. And he has a new book out, Accelerated Minds, Unlocking the Fascinating, Inspiring, and Often Destructive Impulses That Drive the Entrepreneurial Brain. And he's joining us from Toronto today. Neil, how do Elizabeth Holmes and Sam Bankman-Fried fit into your argument in Accelerated Minds? Were their minds accelerating rather too fast? Did they crash rather disastrously, Bankman-Fried and Holmes?
Well, certainly, Andrew, you know, they're entrepreneurs in the sense that, hey, they employed folks, they started something, but they don't, they really represent a far extreme on the entrepreneurial spectrum. I sort of think of those people as getting undue sort of attention and bad attention for entrepreneurs. They don't really represent the vast majority of entrepreneurs who sort of focus on value and building real stuff, not sort of ethereal, a sort of crypto, NFT, Web3 machines that don't do what they claim to do in the case of Theranos. So were their minds accelerated? Perhaps, but they don't, in my view, I'm not really concerned about entrepreneurs like that. They're the type of entrepreneurs who, you know, I'm not terribly concerned with. I'm more concerned with the mental health of those entrepreneurs who are trying to build something lasting for themselves, for their community, that they care about, and yet they fall into ruin, addiction, self-harm.
Right. So I take your point, although one of the intriguing things I think about your book, and you're saying something that may seem obvious but isn't always said, is that entrepreneurship is a form of addiction. It's certainly something that more and more young people are, for better or worse, addicted to. And as you say, Holmes and Bankman-Fried are one extreme. But they themselves seem addicted. Neither of them obviously want to end up in jail. They've shamed themselves, their families, and ruined their lives. What kind of addiction do you think much of today's entrepreneurial world represents? Is this a classic form of addiction like alcohol or gambling or drugs?
Well, it's certainly akin to gambling. So I'm the son of two dopamine scientists, and they focused on how this chemical, this neurotransmitter in the brain, receives and releases dopamine. And in the case of gambling addicts and in the case of entrepreneurs, certain of the receptors, the dopamine receptors, are elevated. So it's similar. The dopamine rush can be similar, and it's especially strong when you start out on your vision toward entrepreneurship, when you start telling the world about what you're trying to achieve. So there are similarities in that respect. The question that I address is whether that, whether that price is worth paying, and what do we do about it? So what I want to do is advocate for sort of a prevention approach to it, and give entrepreneurs, again, the ones I care about the most, they tend to be quiet, not brash and bombastic, the tools to navigate this challenging world of entrepreneurship.
But do they want those tools, Neil? Isn't this a choice that everyone makes? You could still, particularly in Canada, you could get a job as a civil servant. You can go and work in a store. Many are called as entrepreneurs, few are chosen, but they know what they're involved in. The vast majority of entrepreneurs fail, and that's the nature of things.
Yeah, I wish they did know what they were getting into. I don't think they do, actually. I think the pre-entrepreneurial messaging that that we're sending, whether it's from the business schools, the incubators, the accelerators, the financial tech media, is one in which we glorify entrepreneurship, fast money, quick riches. And that's just not the case, right? It's a hard toil. So there's really, many entrepreneurs, most ventures fail, and most young entrepreneurs in particular, really get sideswiped, and it's too late when they realize, after financial ruin, that they're suffering.
You say financial ruin, as long as they're losing other people's money rather than their own. Isn't that the nature of what entrepreneurs do? There are huge wins. Everyone risks it, either as an entrepreneur or as an investor. And what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it at all. And this is the foundation of capitalism. I think what we want to do as a society, I believe, is we want to nurture sort of long-term entrepreneurship. Basically, we want to create more of a free market in entrepreneurship and make sure those who are going into it know what they're doing, and those who are producing wealth for themselves and for all of society don't skid off the rails. And so the tools can be really simple, right? I think early on in the entrepreneurial journey, people can be made aware of services locally in their community that they can take part in. Often coaching entrepreneurial communities. All of these things, I think, can help entrepreneurs really grapple with the reality that they're facing.
Aren't you, though, and I'm making this word up, Neil, you're trying to Canadify entrepreneurship, make it reasonable, make it moderate. But isn't the very nature of entrepreneurship but it doesn't mean that Canada can't have entrepreneurs, but it might not fit as comfortably into your culture in Canada as it certainly does in the United States, which is much more of a zero-sum culture of winners and losers.
Yeah, I would argue that Canadians hold our weight quite well, both in Canada and in Silicon Valley, as hundreds of thousands of Canadians. Canadians are everywhere, Andrew. here in Canada and in the United States, we're on par in terms of the percentage of the labor force that really packs a good punch in entrepreneurship. That being said, you do make a good point about culture. There is a culture in America that I don't know if I'd call it a zero sum game, but there's a healthy respect for those who take risks, and as there is here too. I think really what I want to do is I want to give already successful, hungry entrepreneurs the power to succeed even further.
You mentioned Canadian entrepreneurs. Have you seen the new movie Blackberry?
No, but I'm looking forward to it. We all
it's actually a brilliant film. I saw it a couple of weeks ago before I was in Turkey, about research in motion, and the ups and downs, very dramatic ups and downs. I'd be curious as to you, whether Research in Motion had been an American company, whether it would have had the same rather sad outcome. I mean, is entrepreneurship in Canada treated differently from the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference is that Canada's a very different place than it was even 5 years ago. I'm here in it really, we're a country of new immigrants. Here in Toronto, we have a greater percentage of first immigrant population than New York City. So what we are in Canada is we're the diversity. We live diversity in Canada. So our markets for new immigrant entrepreneurs, which are a growing percentage of entrepreneurs, are global in orientation. It wasn't too long ago that Canada was very narrow looking in terms of its entrepreneurship. So that's changed quite dramatically in Canada over the last 5 to 10 years.
Well, you need to see it, Neil. It's a really good film.
Yeah.
It's about a man. I mean, he's not quite,
yeah,
he's not quite Sam Bankman-Fried or Elizabeth Holmes, but he's certainly someone who, if not broke the law, skirted the law and lost everything. And the ironic thing about the Research in Motion movie, the BlackBerry movie, is the only person who made any money was one of the co-founders who was fired and pushed out, whereas everyone who was supposedly successful failed. You talked about improving capitalism. You wrote an interesting piece with the EU Observer, wishing for a kinder capitalism in 2023, and there's a photo of Ayn Rand's coffin. What does a kind of capitalism mean to you, and how is that bound up in improving the quality of the life, work-life balance for entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so I'm really thinking of historically, right? We talked about the founder's dilemma as being that challenge of how much outside investment Professor Wasserman then at Harvard would talk about versus, you know, how much to take because that you need to balance that against control. And really what's happened now is the short-termism of the investor ecosystem has, you know, put that balance askew such that really the demand for fast return on money is really intense. And again, it's a choice. I'm not suggesting greater regulation. I'm simply saying that we can value patient capital a little bit more. And there are ways to do that. I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about greater scrutiny of investors. They can be accredited, of course, in terms of their net income and net worth. I feel they should also be accredited in terms of their demonstrable commitment to mental health and long-term hold. There's a variety of things we can do to nurture, you know, I call it kinder capitalism, long-term investment. But at the end of the day, in that particular piece where I was referencing Ayn Rand, you know, Ayn Rand talked about focusing on things that are real, and that's what entrepreneurs do. And, you know, they championed libertarians, objectivists, championed sort of property law as the science of ownership. And yet so much of what's being created in fast money entrepreneurialism these days is kind of, you know, it's ethereal. Like, it's not there. Like, whether it's the metaverse or Web3 or NFT, right? Like, we want to build real stuff.
But is AI real? I mean, one of the other big news stories today is that there's an open letter from all the big players in the AI revolution, from OpenAI, Google DeepMind, about the fact that AI poses the risk of extinction. Is AI real? It seems as real as Web3 or crypto. Might be a little bit more substantial, but it might be a bit more viable in business terms. I mean, the internet then, in the way you're describing it, isn't real either.
No, the internet's real. Like, the internet is architecture. And if you think back to and I'll get to AI in a second, that's a bigger conversation. But, you know, the mid-90s, when we created search engines and browsers and the domain name system, the architecture upon which all of this other ethereal stuff is based today, and plus AI is based. I mean, those were real things. .com, in fact, built real stuff. Now, AI, I can't assess the claims on either extreme of this debate. I don't like to call it AI. I like to just to call it knowledge. I think knowledge is real, and the growth and pace and intensity of the accumulation of knowledge is real. Does it pose an extinction risk? I always sort of recoil when people make extreme statements of that nature, but I respect the credentials of those who are saying that. So I think I just need to put on my reflective hat and evaluate their contentions carefully.
You wrote an interesting piece as well for the Toronto Star on hidden burnout, the work-life balance struggles of entrepreneurs. You suggest that they're all working at least 6 days a week, which in California doesn't seem much. I mean, you can't be an entrepreneur, Neil, and work 5 days a week.
No.
You can't do 9-to-5s. No. The nature of being an entrepreneur, as I said earlier, many are called, few are chosen. Most of them burn out. Most of them end in failure. But by definition, you've got to be working 6 or 7 days a week as an entrepreneur, don't you?
Yeah, you do. But you got to work on things that you love, right? So the career advice I like to give young people is, you know, hey, don't get great at stuff that you hate, right? Which is good career advice for wage workers. Challenge with entrepreneurship is the nature of the fast money investor ecosystem right now is pushing entrepreneurs away very, very rapidly from building stuff and building lasting stuff for their community and focusing unduly on, let's just say ambitious financial projections, investor relations and marketing, which, you know, is certainly important, but it is not core to the entrepreneurial mission. You know, what Steve Jobs called making a dent in the universe. You can't really make that dent if you're too much at the behest of short-term investors. I mean, you started your entrepreneurial venture, not to work for the man, but to, you know, create something new.
You mentioned virtual reality. I mean, Apple next week are probably going to come out with some virtual reality goggles, which are certainly going to look better and perhaps be more viable than the stuff being brought out by Meta and other companies. Why is the metaverse not real?
You know, because we tried it and it failed, right? So
well, we've tried AI and it kept on failing, and now we have some success. Aren't they all littered with failures until someone succeeds?
Sometimes. So on the metaverse, I mean, we had Second Life in 2003, and we had a wide range of immersive environments. Again, not to suggest that we shouldn't keep plodding along, but we shouldn't pretend as if it's new, right? With respect to AI, I mean, that I'm of the view that, again, I define it as knowledge accumulation and knowledge accumulation at scale. And so that's clearly torqued up. And so I do believe it's happening. It's at a scale, the implications of which are being debated right now.
I like the title of the book, Neil, Accelerated Minds. Do entrepreneurs have quite literally accelerated minds? You mentioned dopamine and the way in which that makes them addicted to the excitement of startups. How does that impact on the speed of the mind?
Yeah, so, I mean, entrepreneurs do enjoy and manifest a great deal of cognitive flexibility and speed, and they love that. The one condition that's most associated with entrepreneurship, it's often also called CEO disease within the entrepreneurship community, is ADHD, again, associated with accelerated minds. Accelerated minds don't necessarily mean minds that are of greater IQ, greater EQ, but they tend to be what I call mutts, that people who sort of take ideas from one place and map it to another, and then try to bring together different ideas to advance a new solution to an old problem.
What do you make of Elon Musk? I take your point that maybe Elizabeth Holmes and Sam Bankman-Fried aren't really examples of entrepreneurs. They're basically just criminals. But We did a show a couple of weeks ago on Musk, on SpaceX, on Tesla, on Twitter, and all the other initiatives he's involved with. Is Musk exhibit A in your accelerated minds argument?
He's most definitely a subset of exhibit A. He manifests along the spectrum some elements of a community-based, values-based entrepreneur, initiating sort of new ideas for saving the tide, schoolboys, and a whole range of other things he's done honorably around the world. And he's been very open about his own mental health conditions. At the same time, he's committed to excellence and impact. And he's been one of the things I really admire about Elon Musk is so many things to admire, despite the many legitimate criticisms of him, is that he's been very open and transparent about how bloody hard you need to work as an entrepreneur. To
right. your point
earlier, you know, he sort of makes fun and mocks entrepreneurs who work anything less than 7 days a week. So he's real. And I really appreciate that. I think the one thing we need to do desperately is tell new entrepreneurs the truth about the journey that they're about to embark upon.
Next week, I'm doing an interview with an author, Simone Stoltzoff. He has a new book out, The Good Enough Job, Reclaiming Life from Work. Now, your book is not making the same argument. But you are suggesting that there is life outside work. I think for Musk, there isn't. He's happy, or he was happy, sleeping at the Tesla factory for months on end to make it successful. He clearly doesn't have much of a private life. He's a very difficult man. Are entrepreneurs people who simply don't want any life outside work? And should we simply accept that? They may be odd, but that's just the nature of things.
Yeah, I mean, I like to pride myself on being odd, and that's why I'm wearing this sort of odd startup t-shirt. I started as a joke, but I quite like wearing the neurotypic behavior that I manifest. You can have a life inside of working 7 days a week. My late father, he worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day as a dopamine science researcher. He would yell out, according to my mother, dopamine receptors in his dreams. He just lived a life inside of work. This whole sort of, we need to really re-examine these words like work-life balance. Sort of creates a false dichotomy for those of us, and I can consider myself one, who just love to work.
The nature of companies like Google, for example, and this was parodied in a number of novels, is that they do away with the work-life balance. So when you go and work at Google or Facebook, you work on their campus. They provide everything from laundry to gyms to massage. Should we be concerned that successful large corporations like Google and Facebook are themselves doing away with the work life balance? Of course, if you go and work for Google or Facebook, you might be working as a bureaucrat. You're not necessarily going in there as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Those companies have really metamorphosed considerably from the culture they once had, and you don't know to what extent that serves their investors versus their recruitment and retention needs in the current labor force market. I mean, I think you're pointing to a larger problem or issue, and that is how to signal to young people in particular that working hard in and of itself is important. To the extent that the workplace, let's just say, diminishes hard work, that, in my view, puts a company at risk. And actually, we see that right now in the world of AI. I mean, if anything, these big tech behemoths should be really terribly worried about, just the large number of small little startups, two person, three person shops that are working 7 days a week, trying to beat them on the metrics of success in AI.
So who would be an example of an entrepreneur who's living the right, correctly, shall we say, balanced life? You mentioned your father who murmured about dopamine in his sleep. He clearly was incapable of switching off. We talked about Holmes and Bankman-Fried, who aren't even entrepreneurs, and Musk. Are there models of entrepreneurs who we should try to emulate? Steve Jobs is often talked about in Silicon Valley, but he was also someone who had no life outside work, whose relations with his children suffered, who was loathed by many of the people who worked for him.
Yeah, you know, so I, again, just to get away from the sort of the work-life balance sort of thing, I mean, I think you can work 7 days a week and work brutally hard, but you can also do things like philosophic consolation. I believe in there's a whole range of neuromodulation techniques that are popular among entrepreneurs. Just to take 5 minute checks during the day, there's a great number of ideas around contemplating your own mortality, your own insignificance in the larger universe.
In the middle of a product planning meeting, you should contemplate your own insignificance and your own imminent death. Is that what you're suggesting?
Maybe not imminently before, but you should have a reminder of that. Absolutely. I mean, what I'm preaching here is obviously Stoicism and the great works.
I know you had a piece recently about Plato's advice to discontented workers, at least be virtuous, or perhaps the real advice is read Plato.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Not a lot of fun, Neil, though. I mean, what about watching TV or watching football on television or just having some fun? You're a terribly serious fellow, aren't you?
Yes, I'm earnest.
We can blame your father for that and his dopamine fetish.
Yes, indeed. I'm obsessed with dopamine too. I understand why my father was obsessed with it. What I've done is I've simply matched the dopamine science and looked at the entrepreneurship research, and the two don't really talk to one another. And that's what's interesting, right? You get in the field of economics, you get people citing themselves, but not the scientific research, and vice versa, and same in psychology. And what's really needed to this complex discussion about what makes an entrepreneur tick, what makes an entrepreneur get off the rails, is what I call, you know, interdisciplinarity, really sort of cross-fertilizing, sharing ideas, and understanding why entrepreneurs are at risk and why we love them. We love them. We absolutely love them. But we want to make sure that they don't do themselves harm, because our collective prosperity increasingly depends on entrepreneurs.
Scientists have shown, I think, from their research that children can have the same addictions as their parents when it comes to drugs and alcohol and perhaps gambling. What about dopamine in terms of entrepreneurship, Neil? Can that be passed on from father to son? Did you quite literally inherit your father's, not just his interest in dopamine, but your high levels? Because you sound in some ways rather like him. You're doing different things. You're a data entrepreneur. He was a dopamine scientist, but you're both highly obsessed with your work.
Yeah. We haven't found any proof of genetic inheritance in entrepreneurship. So no gene for entrepreneurship. The investor community, I mean, I've been an investor too. I do believe that sort of one indicator of success is often if the entrepreneur is the son or daughter of an entrepreneur or was mentored by an entrepreneur for a long period of time. But I don't have any genetic proof of that. We do see now dopamine receptors being elevated in the brain of entrepreneurs, and that's sort of interesting. I think over time we could test your hypothesis, but it hasn't been proven yet.
Can we individually, can we test our dopamine? Can we learn whether we have these, what you call dopamine receptors? So some people have larger ones than others.
Yeah, they get, I mean, we all have, there's five dopamine receptors in the brain. Five dopamine receptors that receive the dopamine in the brain. And we all have them. The question is to what extent they're magnified and to what extent and how we, the intensity of dopamine release. Like we all, what dopamine does is it attaches salience to things that we invest meaning in, right? So for those of us who attach meaning to making money, what my grandfather called sleet or making money, then making the sleet is what you attach value to from a very early age. And for others of us, it's different. So it's not so much whether we have the receptor activity or not. It's the speed of the release and how we can modulate them. And we know, I mean, we know through tests and experimentation that when people are given dopamine inducing drugs, they take greater risks. And so we have evidence of the connection.
Finally, Neil, should all this be taught in business school?
No.
Are you suggesting that the kind of kids who go to business school already will have a propensity towards accelerated minds and maybe more vulnerable to the dopamine that you're describing in your work? Should business schools be wary of this in the same way as getting them ready for a life of entrepreneurship? Also reiterating the work-life balance and the responsibility and all the other things that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, business schools these days increasingly talk about well-being. I think mental health is more the preserve of medicine and public health. You know, entrepreneurs come from everywhere. They don't necessarily, they're not hatched in business schools. But that being said, I think in particular, the financial media, the tech media, the investor community, I think that's where the message needs to come from. That's where it's more effective, I think.
Well, Neil, I'm going to take your advice. I'm going to check out. No more work today. I'm going to drink. Going to gamble. Going to have a lot of sex. So thank you so much. And I hope you do the same, Neil. Are you? You're not going to work the rest of the evening, are you?
Yes, I will. And I'm... Oh dear. My work's a bit different. I'm going to philosophize.
Good. Well, good luck with that.
Thanks, Andrew.